Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. It's wedding season, so we thought we'd revisit two of our favorite essays about tying the knot. First up, Ada Calhoun. In her Modern Love essay, The Wedding Toast I'll Never Give, she lifts her glass to the true challenges of marriage. Catherine Hahn of the Amazon series Transparent and I Love Dick reads us Ada's essay.
While away at a conference in Minneapolis, I was awakened at dawn by a call from my husband in our New York apartment. Our 8-year-old son had just roused him with a suspicion that they might not make their 7:30 a.m. flight to join me because it was now 7:40 and they were still at home. The original plan had us all traveling to Minneapolis together. I would attend my conference, my musician husband would do a show at this school club, and our son would get hotel pool time. Triple win. Then my husband was offered a great gig in New York for the same day we were set to leave, so he called to change his and our son's tickets. Changing them, he learned, was going to cost more than buying a new pair of one-way tickets out. So he did that instead, planning to use their original return tickets, not realizing that if you don't use the first leg, they cancel the second. That meant buying new return tickets at a cost somewhere between, ugh, and what have you done? Now, after all that, my family had missed the first leg of the new itinerary. On hold with the airline yet again, my husband was texting me sexy emojis. Focus, I replied, with an emoji of an airplane. He sent me an emoji of a flan. He and I married young for our urban friend group. In our late 20s, and now in our late 30s, we find ourselves attending the weddings of peers. My husband of 11 years and I sit at these weddings, listening to our excited friends describe all the ways in which they will excel at being married. I will always be your best friend, they say, reading from wrinkled pieces of paper held in shaking hands. I will never let you down. I clap along with everyone else. I love weddings. Still, there is so much I want to say. I want to say that one day you and your husband will fight about missed flights, and you'll find yourself wistful for the days when you had to pay for only your own mistakes. I want to say that at various points in your marriage, may it last forever, you will look at this person and feel only rage. You will gaze at this man you once adored and think, it sure would be nice to have this whole place to myself. In Zen Buddhism, meditation helps practitioners detach from the cycle of desire and suffering. In my brief stint as a religious studies major, I preferred Pure Land Buddhism, an alternate path to enlightenment for people who, as one professor told us, may find it difficult to abandon worldly pain and passion because those things can also yield such beauty and comfort. He summed it up as, life is suffering, and yet. I think about that all the time. And yet. Such hedging to me is good religion, and also the key to a successful marriage. In the course of being together forever, you come across so many and yets, only some of them involving domestic air travel. I love this person, and yet she is such a mess. And yet, when I'm sick, he's not very nurturing. And yet, we don't want the same number of children. And yet, I sometimes wonder what it would be like to be single again. The longer you're with someone, the more big and little and yets rack up. You love this person. Of course you plan to be with him or her forever. And yet, forever can begin to seem like a long time. Breaking up and starting fresh, which everyone around you seems to be doing, can begin to look like a wonderful and altogether logical proposition. But, and yet, works the other way too. Even during the darkest moments of my own marriage, I have had these nagging exceptions. And yet, we still make each other laugh. And yet, he is still my person. And yet, I still love him. Let's see, don't break up. And you outlast some more of your friends' marriages. The way to stay married, my mother says, is not to get divorced. Later that morning, while waiting to hear from my husband about the flights, I decided to kill time looking at houses on Trulia's near me. When I used to travel alone as a teenager, I would stare at houses wherever I was and imagine what it would be like to live there. Now I can still do that, but I can also call up Trulia on my phone and see how much they cost. Comparing houses in Minneapolis, I found I actually preferred the cheaper, more ramshackle, family-friendly ones. Like a two-bedroom that had classic old-world charm, hardwood floors, a built-in buffet. So much better, really, than the pricier one-bedroom I would live in as a single person on the other side of Powderhorn Park. Its new ceiling fans, three-seater closets, and a breakfast nook. What would I even do with three-seater closets? Meanwhile, still no word from my husband about the flights. One thing I love about marriage, and I love a lot of things about marriage, is that you can have a bad day, or even a bad few years, full of doubt and fights and confusion and storming out of the house, but as long as you don't get divorced, you're no less married than couples who never have had a hint of trouble. I mean, I'm told such people exist. It is easy for people who have never tried to do anything as strange and difficult as being married to say marriage doesn't matter, or to condemn those who fail at it, or to mock those who even try. But there's so much beauty in the trying and the failing and in the trying again. At weddings, I do not contradict my beaming newlywed friends when they talk about how they will gracefully succeed where nearly everyone in human history has floundered. I only wish I could tell them that they will suffer occasionally in this marriage. And not only sitcom-grade squabbles, but possibly even dark night of the soul despair. But I would go on to say, had I not by that point been thrown out of the banquet hall, epic failure is part of being human, and it is definitely part of being married. It's part of what being alive means. Occasionally screwing up in expensive ways. That's part of what marriage means. Sometimes hating this other person, but staying together because you promised you would. And then days or weeks later, waking up and loving him again. Loving him still. Finally, nearly 2 hours after my husband's original flight left, I texted him to ask if he was still on hold. "We just got in a cab," he replied. "Flying Air Wisconsin, baby." "Did you have to pay for the tickets again?" I texted. The phone was silent. In that quiet moment, sitting in my hotel room, I found myself daydreaming about the one-bedroom apartment looking out onto Powderhorn Park. After waking up alone, I'd brew some coffee, switch on one of my many ceiling fans, grab a robe from my largest cedar closet, and head for my breakfast nook. "Nope," he wrote back. And suddenly, I was back in the bigger place on the cheaper side of the park. My family was coming to join me, and I was glad.
Catherine Hahn, reading Ada Calhoun's essay, The Wedding Toast I'll Never Give. Ada Calhoun has a new memoir out now, inspired by her modern love essay. The memoir's called Wedding Toasts I'll Never Give.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Now to our second essay. We've probably all known or heard about a bride who went overboard, who lost perspective and became impossible in the run-up to her wedding. Reality television is full of bridezillas, but at Craig Bridger's wedding, the tables were turned. John Cho plays Hikaru Sulu in the most recent Star Trek reboot and stars in the new film Columbus. He reads Craig's essay, Men Don't Care About Weddings? Groomzilla is Hurt.
I'm not the type of guy who would want to plan a wedding. I would rather play Xbox than watch Say Yes to the Dress. I don't know if I'm a fall or a summer. I decorated our bathroom with a framed Batman comic book. But I found myself engaged to a wonderful woman who is so overbooked and so chronically late that she has her own time zone. We call it Terra time. I knew I had to step up if I wanted to make it down the aisle. And when I did, something unrecognizable began to stir inside me. Everyone knows about Bridezilla, the toothy creature in a wedding dress whose apocalyptic meltdowns send bystanders running for cover. But I'm here to tell you there is a far more terrible beast lurking in the matrimonial jungle. Fear him, for he is among us. His name is Groomzilla. And at my wedding, he was me. It all started with a tie dilemma. I can see that now. I wonder if Groomzilla could have been stopped then, if I could have killed him in the shell, as Brutus proposed to do to Caesar, had I only known. Listen, I do not wear ties unless I need one for an audition. I'm an actor and a writer. What I'm trying to say is, I'm a bartender. So I have never thought much about ties. I have never noticed them in stores or on necks. But not long after my fiancé and I finally settled on a date, ties began to haunt me. I started to see them in my sleep. When I slept, which I didn't, because I was always lying awake thinking about ties. As it turns out, New York is a city teeming with ties. And none of them looked right for my wedding. Tara, logging 12-hour days, teaching and studying Pilates, had no time for my sartorial crisis. I had nothing but a skinny swatch from her champagne-colored sash and my own waffling sense of fashion to guide me. So I did the only sensible thing. I bought every champagne tie I liked everywhere and took them all home. I bought ties from Bloomingdale's, Macy's, Barney's, Banana Republic? And one from Paul Stewart that cost almost as much as my wedding band. At home, I held them up to my throat, fanned them out on the table like a silken royal flush, and wondered just what was happening to me. But my obsession went beyond ties. When it came to writing the invitations, the wedding programs, and those little save-the-date cards, vanity didn't get me into trouble. Ego did. Tara played my ego like a well-tuned kazoo. "Baby, you're such a good writer," she would tell me via cell phone, on a breathless break between clients and class. "You're so good with words." And suddenly, I would be back at the computer, birthing tumescent phrases like, "Under the setting sun, Tara and Craig will at last be wed." I agonized over whether to quote A Midsummer Night's Dream or Romeo and Juliet on the response card. And then I agonized over whether to use a semicolon or comma in said quote, because frankly, many Shakespeare authorities disagree on that. I hadn't asked for the job, but now that it was mine, I was determined to write pure wedding poetry. Tara and I settled into a pattern. I would tease out a brilliant idea, and she would come home and veto it, which would only feed my blooming hysteria. True, she often had a point. For instance, maybe it was tacky to format the invitation like a movie poster and write that our wedding was produced by God Almighty. But still, she didn't have to tell me that. The creative process is a delicate thing. And when she would critique my genius, I would immediately grow resentful. Why was I stuck writing the ooey-gooey stuff? I'm a dude. It insulted my dignity, like training a cat to wear a mouse on its head. And I never received credit for my labors anyway. After I created an email account for our wedding and sent out a custom-made, and I might add, fabulous, save-the-date e-card, I was flooded with replies praising Tara, who was in England with her mother, for the delightful message. Right up to the wedding, some guests continued to respond to my email messages by writing to Tara, even though I signed them all Craig. People just couldn't fathom that the groom, not the bride, might be leading our frantic march to I Do. When we were first engaged, I was advised by friends to nod and stay out of Tara's way. And despite the fact that more and more grooms are now very involved in wedding planning, the traditional wisdom remains that a groom, like a child, should be seen and not heard. Real men, the logic goes, don't care about weddings. And that hurts Groomzilla. That makes him cry. But only on the inside. He doesn't want to streak his self-tanning lotion. Months after the ceremony, in my desperate search for answers, I called Dr. Kathleen Gerson, a sociology professor at New York University, and asked her why some of the wedding chores made me feel emasculated. "I don't like that term," she told me. "Emasculate implies that there's only one way to be a man." Oh. I didn't tell her that being swiftly corrected when trying to use big words like emasculated also makes me feel emasculated. I felt better, though, when I asked her if she thought I was a wimp. "You are absolutely not a wimp," she said. "You're the opposite of a wimp. You're a pioneer." "Woo-hoo-hoo! That's more like it. A pioneer. A frontiersman in an unmapped gender wilderness." I wish I had known Dr. Gerson before the wedding. Then again, imagining myself as a rugged adventurer wouldn't have crossed anything off my towering to-do list. It wouldn't have lowered my blood pressure. Overstressed and underappreciated, I staggered toward my wedding weekend like, well, an overgrown lizard swatting buildings and planes from his furious path. Tara and I fought whenever someone said the word wedding. I resented her busy schedule and her carefree attitude. She resented my acting like a jerk. I skulked around our apartment, dragging my tail across the wooden floor, bellowing about everything from gift registries to whether the groomsmen should escort the bridesmaids down the aisle. But when I sounded my reptilian roar at my soon-to-be sister-in-law, I had gone too far. Oh, I could make excuses. I might mention that I had scrambled to gather the wedding license, the rings, the programs, the music, and the gifts for the bridal party. I could point out that I had played tour guide on a bus that my father chartered to take the out-of-town guests from New York City to Chappaqua, where Tara and I arrived too late for our scheduled meeting with the minister. And after all that, with minutes to go before we had to be at the rehearsal, I just wanted to go to the bathroom. But there they were, Tara and Natalie, my fiancé and her sister-in-law, standing in the bathroom doorway, chatting. I stood on one foot, and then the other. I waited for them to notice me, and then I lost it.
How about you get out of the way and shut the door so I can have a little privacy?
I shouted.
How about that?
When I saw the disgust on Natalie's face, I realized what I'd done. Moments later, in the bathroom mirror, the ugly truth grimaced back at me. Scales. Claws. The thick-lidded eyes of a beast. In a way, my shameful outburst saved me. I didn't want to be that thrashing, tense creature at my own wedding. I started to breathe. Things weren't going to be perfect. And with my bride anyway, they weren't going to happen on time. Just acknowledging this fact helped exorcise Groomzilla. Sometime in the night, he turned his gnarled back to the world and lumbered out to sea, leaving me neurotic, nervous, but whole. And on the big day, even though I had to wait an hour for Tara, standing in the sun in my sharp black suit, while the photographer took some pre-ceremony pictures, I felt fantastic. Someone handed me a glass of wine. I looked at my mom and dad, the arriving guests, the people I love. And when my bride appeared in the doorway, everything else, the stress, tantrums, the petty details, the shocking price tag, melted away. I was getting married. It has been 3 months now, and Groomzilla is just an embarrassing memory. A lot of people told me our wedding was the best they had ever been to. Is that just something you're supposed to say, like telling your Aunt Clara, that was the best liver I've ever tasted? I don't know. It certainly was the best day of my life. But sometimes, late at night, I'm still plagued with doubt. Maybe I should have gone with the Paul Stewart tie.
John Cho reading Craig Bridger's essay, Men Don't Care About Weddings, Groomzilla is Hurt.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Coming up next week, Jane Atkinson from Netflix's House of Cards on one mother's difficult choice.
After I hung up, there was a dead silence. My husband reaching for my hand. I told myself I had made a horrible mistake. The legal system now owned my vulnerable son, the same boy who only a few years ago I would have described as sweet, dreamy, hardworking, and unfailingly honest.
Remember, you can hear every episode from our archives at wbur.org/modernlove. Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, and Amory Sievertson. We got production help from Catherine Brewer. Additional sound design by Matt Reed. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.